Well, did you ever find a fossil and wondered what the heck it was? We're going to be talking about a new book that may help you identify maybe that fossil that you've got sitting on your desk or on the kitchen table or whatever. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network, and great to have in the studio with me a couple of guests. Ken Gass is one of my guests. He's been studying paleontology, collecting fossils in Wisconsin for more than 50 years, and he's written a book on subjects ranging from paleontology to procedures, and has published in magazines, peer-reviewed journals. Ken Gass, welcome. Yeah, thanks so much for joining us today. Also with us today, Don McCulloch. Don is the curator at the Weiss Earth Science Museum in Menasha, retired as a senior paleontologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And these guys have gotten together on a book. It's called Fossils of the Milwaukee Formation. It's packed with wonderful photos of fossils with a lot of great information about those fossils, and it's really kind of fun to look through, I'll tell you that for sure. So what do you like about fossils? What questions might you have about them? I hope you'll join in the conversation. This book talks about the fossils of the Milwaukee Formation. I want to find out why the heck they chose Milwaukee. And we'll answer that question and a whole lot more, and certainly yours too. So if you'd like to join in, you can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. And Ken, by the way, welcome again. Thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you.
Don, thank you so much for joining us as
well.
Thanks
for having us on.
Really appreciate it. Well, how'd you guys get interested?
And I think we both started out in about the late 1950s just looking for things that we could find in nature. I found fossils in about 1959 or so of things in the Milwaukee area. And looking for dinosaurs, of course, like any other kid would be.
Yeah.
There aren't any in the state, but there are lots of other things. And I started doing that and just kind of caught. And Don, you can explain how you got into it.
Well, I'm a child of television, of course, and I saw my first dinosaurs on television. And that got me interested in this stuff, and I've been looking at it ever since.
Well, let's get right to the basics here. How is a fossil formed, or does it make a difference depending on where the animal or thing happens to be?
Oh, there's a real big difference. A lot of the conditions will depend on what will determine what the preservation is. There are hard parts, actual hard parts preserved, like, of course, a mammoth skeleton in glacial ice, for example. You can have specimens turn into rocks through various means, permineralization, where minerals are added to the bone material or the shell material or other hard parts. You have replacement with other minerals that are dissolved in groundwater. You can have just the actual skeletal materials dissolve away completely and just have a mold left where the animal or plant or whatever used to be. So there's lots of different ways. They all involve burial of some sort or another, generally in the sediment, under the water generally.
Oh, and that's what keeps makes the fossil be? It has to be underwater typically?
Typically, yes. Yeah, it's got to be buried to be preserved, and generally rapid burial before everything can deteriorate away. Of course, in most cases, it's only the hard parts that remain. But in some extreme cases, you can have softer materials. And in the Milwaukee Formation, you do have a lot of examples where you have plant fossils and some other trace fossils and things like that don't actually have any hard parts as such that do get preserved. And that's pretty rare, really, to form fossils of soft-bodied animals or fossils of plants, for example.
Yeah, that's interesting. You get a lot of information. Don, do you get a lot of information from a fossil, or can you?
Yeah, you can tell all kinds of stuff about how animals lived, what environments were like in the past, how things changed through time. how evolution works. That's all basic information that you derive from fossils. And the concept of geologic time is something that developed from the study of fossils in the early 1800s. People recognized that looking at layers of rocks, successive layers of rocks, you're getting changes in the fossils that you find there. And that gave people an idea, well, things might have changed through time as opposed to not changing at all. People didn't understand that animals could go extinct in the early 1800s. That was a radical idea. So people thought things were always the way they were, and yeah, the fossils show that they've changed quite a bit.
That's interesting. Why did you guys pick – I think I know why, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Why did you pick Milwaukee, the Milwaukee area, for your book?
Well, we're both from Milwaukee originally, and that's our neighborhood in which we could find fossils.
Grew up looking at finding fossils.
That's right. And the Milwaukee Formation, of course, is named after Milwaukee because that's where it exists. Only in northeastern Milwaukee County will you ever find it. And so we acquired this material, this information that we'd been accumulating through all the years, and finally decided it was time for somebody to write a book about this, because the last book that was written was around 1911, and that wasn't exclusively about Milwaukee Formation. It was other Devonian formations in the same state. But this is the most fossiliferous one, the one that's most prolific and diverse. And the Milwaukee Formation is actually one of the most diverse formations in all the Middle Devonian of North America. We have all different kinds of invertebrates. We have fish fossils. We have even terrestrial fossils that washed into the sea and got preserved. So there's all kinds of things that you can find in the Milwaukee Formation that you know, really, and a lot of things that are just found exclusively here in the Milwaukee Formation and not other states, a lot of the species and whatnot.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. Maybe, Don, maybe you can do this. Talk a bit about how your book is organized, and I did not mention you have a couple of other co-authors with you as well.
Correct. The book is organized mostly looking at the different types of fossils that you find in the Milwaukee Formation in Milwaukee and the general stratigraphy, which is a concept of how the rocks change through time, different rock units. And then we have a lot of historical information about the industry that's responsible for finding the Milwaukee Formation fossils.
There's a little bit of history in here, which is kind of cool. The other authors, were they Milwaukee people too at one point, or Joanne?
Joanne died last year. She was Don's wife, and she was working on the book with us. But she's originally from Milwaukee also, and she has worked a lot in the area and collected with Don also in Milwaukee Formation and other places. Carlton Brett is from the University of Cincinnati. He hasn't really worked specifically until this book with the Milwaukee Formation, but he's very diverse in his experience and his paleontological endeavors, and really helped a lot with the book.
He's from New York, and he has done a lot of work on Devonian age fossils elsewhere besides Milwaukee.
Okay, that makes sense then. Who's your audience for the book, do you think?
Anybody.
Yeah.
The pictures, of course, can draw in anybody, and it's mainly a picture book. There's more of that than there is writing, but it's for educators, it's for students, it's for casual collectors, anybody who's interested in fossils or even might become interested.
And history, too. We put a lot of history in, both the history of science and the history of the industry. The fact that there was quarries in the late 1800s or people actually digging in these rocks for economic reasons is the reason we have all the fossils to study. If it wasn't for them, we'd know a lot less about the Milwaukee Formation.
And we wouldn't even have a book.
We wouldn't have a book either.
There you go. Well, what about the kind of rock and so forth? Milwaukee was kind of, you know, it's Cream City. It has that nickname, and it has to do a little bit with the rock and so forth from there.
The Cream City rock typically is actually not even from Wisconsin. It's from the Mississippian age of Indiana and other states. But there is a lot of building stone, he's an industrial geologist, so he can answer that better than I can. There's a lot of rock from Wisconsin that does make up a lot of the buildings around here. Most of it is Silurian, I would think. But
yeah, it's if you go back in the 1800s, most people were still using stone to build large structures as they had done for 10,000 years. You make big blocks of stone, you burn lime to stick the stone and bricks or whatever you're trying to put together, and that was the way it went. In the early 1800s, people started to use cement, better cementing materials. And Milwaukee happened to be a place where the rock there had the right combination of clay and limestone to make natural cement. And it became a leader in the United States, one of the biggest producers and most modern producers at the time of making natural cement.
And you have a photo in your book of the Milwaukee Cement Company.
Right, right. So if you go back in the late 1800s, that would have been a major industry in Milwaukee. Everybody knows about breweries, and that certainly Milwaukee has been a big manufacturing city. But the Milwaukee Cement Company was kind of a showcase place. There wasn't any other big cement producers in the area. And tourists would come to see the cement works, and they would have, if there was a big convention of some kind, they might all go out and see the cement works. So it was a real famous place. And, of course, it's completely gone now, so nobody knows much about it anymore.
And most of the fossil went along with them.
Yeah.
The quarries were gone, and so most of the fossil collecting went as well. So.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, I would have expected, you know, back in the day, if I'm working in the rocks or the stones or whatever, and I see a fossil, I'm not going to just bust that up. I'm going to hang on to it if I can. Is that kind of the history of it a little bit?
Well, I think as Don mentions in the chapter that he did, a lot of times people would pay the quarry workers to keep these fossils, put them aside, and they would actually get paid more doing that than they would on their actual job of working in the quarry.
Yes.
So there was incentive to find some good fossils.
They became enthusiastic fossil collectors. They could double their salary sometimes as the fossils they were finding.
Well, that's great, though. And in the end, then, you guys have...
It's a win-win. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a win for everybody then.
It was.
Well, we should take some calls. Ron in Greendale will give you a chance to join in. Thanks a lot for calling, Ron. What's on your mind?
Well, I have to say that Don and Joanne are truly rock stars. And wonderful educators, and so sorry for her passing. But I'm sure that Don's working with a fabulous group here, and I wanted him to perhaps mention a little bit about the Green Museum and Dr. Day's early collections and how they've gone off and spread out into the world. And we'll leave it there.
All right.
Yeah, the Green Museum is a wonderful collection of fossils. It's on the campus of the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. It was collected by a pharmacist in Milwaukee, where he actually ran a drug company named Thomas Green. And he had been interested in natural history subjects when he grew up in Rhode Island. He moved to Milwaukee, and in his late 60s, he was told he needed to relax, so he became an obsessive compulsive fossil collector, which didn't relax him very much. But he built a fantastic collection of fossils, and the cement company quarries at Milwaukee were the things that were real popular at the time, and he actually became a member of the board of directors because he wanted access to the collections and have the quarry workers save them for him. So he ended up with a fantastic collection that's really not been well studied. And it's on the campus. It's a very beautiful collection of fossils. It can't be duplicated anymore. Very important scientifically. And
can anybody go and look at them?
They have a gallery in Lapham Hall, and you can go there. I'm not sure what the hours are, but you can go and look at a lot of the fossils that are on exhibit from the Milwaukee Formation.
That's really cool. Ron, thanks a lot for calling. By the way, Greg called, he couldn't stay online, but wondered, is it okay to, or is it legal to sell, you find a fossil on your property, or maybe you find it in a state park or something.
It gets a little sticky with
sell.
I'm not sure what the laws are when it comes to selling in particular cases, but I do know that as far as collecting goes, there is only one real good place to collect fossils from the Milwaukee Formation, for example, since that's what we're talking about, and that is not even legal to collect fossils there anymore. That's Estabrook Park in Milwaukee. I just found that out for sure last year when I was preparing for the book, and we were looking at it and seeing what the options were. And we aren't even, as researchers, aren't even allowed to go back there and collect. So that's one thing to be cautious about. Just, is it legal to collect it to begin with? Selling it, I'm not really good at that. That's a legal thing, and I'm not
well,
sure.
Well, this is the United States. You can sell anything. So if you find something on your land, you
on
can
your
sell
own
it.
Land,
yeah,
at least.
Yeah. Yeah. Federal land is a different story. Your parks is a different story. But there's no restrictions in this country about doing that. Some other countries have restrictions on what you can sell, or sometimes, like you find archaeological materials in the UK, you have to sell those to the government. They'll give you a fair price for it. But if they deem it important, they get to take care of it.
There you go. Well, lots of callers online. We'll get to Tom next in Hayward. But just to remind you, talking today with Don Mikulik and Ken Gass, they are two of the authors of the book Fossils of the Milwaukee Formation, a diverse Middle Devonian biota from Wisconsin, USA. Tons of photos and some great explanation and some good history in here as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, our engineer today, Nigel O'Shea, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at a new book titled Fossils of the Milwaukee Formation with two of the authors, Ken Gass and Don Mikulik, and great to have them along. Certainly, if you have a question for them, you can join in at 800-642-1234. Give us a call. Tom and Hayward, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
When I was a young boy, we were building our home. This is over by Stillwater, Minnesota. We were about 10 miles west of the Wisconsin border in the St. Croix River. We were high on top of a hill, and about 2 feet down into the soil, there was all these seashells, and it was like they were obviously seashells. They weren't particularly, they didn't look like fossils like you'd find out by the river. And it's puzzled me to this day, and that was quite a while ago because we're talking about 1955. And we found arrowheads around there too. We could never, they weren't fossils in the sense that they looked so incredibly real. And I was just wondering how they'd get on top of a hill that far away from a river, 2 feet down.
Tom has been thinking about this since 1955, Ken. So can you shed any light on this?
Without seeing them, it's almost impossible to tell, but that's a cop-out. I will say that I'm a little bit suspicious that they're really old. Did you find these in rock at all? Was there any rock encasing any of these fossils?
No.
Because I know
it was like a vein of them. It was just like a bunch of them.
Unless it's Pleistocene, Don.
It's probably some more recent stuff. The idea is on a hill is a problem, but it's common to find shells that are simply buried in old lake beds or swamps or river bends and stuff like that. From the Quaternary Age, which is the age of glaciation in this area, which can be a couple million years old and it can be only a few thousand years old. But having it on a hill is a little bit of a problem. I guess we'd have to see it.
You'd wonder if the glaciers, the glaciers kind of move things around quite a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and stream erosion could make a hill. In other words, it might have been a flat area at one time and it's been eroded and you're left with a hill and these things happen to be on the top of it.
Yeah, that's probably a pretty good guess as to what might have been going on there, Tom. Thanks a lot for calling. Let's go to Kay in Sauk Prairie next. Kay, thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, my question takes us far away from the Midwest. I wondered if your guests would explain the La Brea tar pits.
Well, the La Brea tar pits, if you go to the La Brea area before it was built over, there was natural occurrences of oil coming to the surface. It's an oil field like you can find everywhere. But in this case, oil would seep to the surface and sort of pond up and things. And when they started to excavate that oil, or tar at the time, in the late 1800s, they started to find all these funny bones in there. And it took them a long time to realize they were bones of animals from an ice age. So you commonly see the representation of pits of tar where animals walk in there and get stuck in that, and that's how they get deposited in this situation. Probably more of it is just a preservational thing where these animals died in an area and the oil seeping through the soil had a lot to do with preserving a lot of the bones there. So it's a combination of both. So it's a trap for animals in the ice age. They'd come and they'd get stuck in these tar pits. And also it's just a preservational thing where a lot of bones end up just being preserved. They're there for other reasons, but the oil is what's preserving them.
Yeah, interesting. I was thinking back to a time when I spent a year at the University of the West Indies in Trinidad, and there's a La Brea tar pit in Trinidad, and I can remember having a guide walking us out to the into the pit and then asking if we wanted the way back, he probably would like to charge us an extra $10.
There are other tar pits, there's some in Peru, I think, and I'm sure there's other ones in the world, too.
It's also interesting that the Milwaukee Formation itself actually has some tar or asphalt.
Oh, it does.
A little bit in some of these cavities that are in part of the formation. And Don, you can explain, wasn't there some explorers that actually used this, this as pitch to repair their boats or
in
something
in the
like
1617s, I think one of the French priests that came through the area, they found, as they're going along the Lake Michigan shore in canoes, they found an outcrop of this, and they used it to help seal damaged parts of their canoes and stuff. So it, it has a practical purpose.
Oh, yes.
And sometimes when you get it real, when it's real hard and really like a piece of tar, I've heard of stories of children back in the olden days chewing it like gum. I don't know how healthy that is, but that's what they were doing.
They wouldn't recommend it.
No, I there were some stories, you know, speculation that Columbus, when he was in the West Indies and in the Trinidad area, they actually used La Brea for fixing holes in his ships he had. Well, let's take another call. By the way, you can join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Lashia, I believe it is, in Spring Green. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I've always been fascinated by fossils, and I just wanted to share that when I grew up in the 50s in the Davenport, Iowa, everybody, we lived in a new development, and everybody who got a new driveway, got crushed limestone, and they were just, it was just solid fossils. It was all bivalves that were about an inch across, and little kids would just go in everybody's driveways and just, you know, looking for fossils. I just thought it was really neat.
It's the same thing around Milwaukee. There's not a lot of quarries and rock outcrops to look for fossils. But when I was a kid, everybody had crushed stone in their driveways, and we could find – that was the easiest place to look for fossils was in the driveways. And, of course, that would annoy some of the neighbors. They didn't want kids hanging around their driveways, I guess, collecting fossils. But we would do that anyways. So that's that was a source of fossils that we utilized in the past.
So it kept your interest up in fossils then. Did you save any of those, Lashia?
I don't know where they went to. I know I did, but, you know, my mom liked to throw stuff away, so I don't know.
Especially dirty rocks.
Dirty rocks. There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Do you have some do you guys still go out and look around for fossils?
I do when I can. I travel a little bit, and wherever I go, I try to see if there's something. It's getting harder to find places, though, to find fossils that are still legal, accessible. But it's like Don said, alluded to, it's not as easy as it was a long time ago when the quarries were still operational and the parks were still okay with you collecting fossils there. You still can occasionally. If you go walking up and down Lake Michigan and looking at the beach sediment, a lot of times you can still find fossils there, and that's pretty accessible, and it's legal to find them there. There are places you can do that. If you can get permission from the property owners, wherever you see rocks, especially if you know that there are rocks that might contain fossils, you have a good chance of finding something.
And what would be the rocks that you'd want to, you know, I've, say, okay, there's a possibility there's going to be fossils here?
I would first try to do a little research to find out where they're likely to be and what to look for as far as what kind of rocks are found with fossils in a certain geographic area. That's a very general answer to your question. I think most of the quarries in Wisconsin, since that's what we're talking, is have some kind of, as long as it's not a granite quarry or something up in the northern part of the state or north of the central part of the state, they probably have some kind of fossils in there in some part or another of the quarry. But the trick is to getting into the quarry and having access.
There you go. Jeff in Pelican Lake, let's go to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. What an interesting program. I have to relate a story. When we were little kids and Brown Deer was being developed, all these new subdivisions are going in, one of our friends bought a home there, one of the first homes, and so when we'd go visit, we'd go to all the new excavation sites and pick up fossils. And there was a railroad track that went through that area. So it's north of Brown Deer Road where a railroad track went through. But we would leave, when we'd go home back to the east side of Milwaukee, we'd have pockets full of fossils. The seashells, and I think we also pick up iron pyrite. Would that be right?
Yeah, you were probably in the Milwaukee Formation, wouldn't you think so, Don?
Yeah, that sounds exactly. There's a big outcrop there, not very well exposed, but
it's
there.
Right.
Yeah, very cool. Do you, Jeff, still have any of those?
Oh yes, I keep them, man. I show them. Sometimes I'm tempted to give them away to little kids, but I'm going, well, I don't know. You know, we had spent the whole day out in the field, you know, finding all these things. I don't think I'm going to give these away because it's kind of rare to see them around. We could get full shells, you know. Yes. You just pick them up, it would be a whole shell at the top and bottom stuck together.
Yeah, that's great. That's you should check out the book. You can probably identify them. They're probably in there, you know.
I was just going to say that you'd be
there. You go.
You'd want to take a look at it because if you've got a bunch, why not have it? Check it out, and I likely should be able to. In the book, I would be really amazed.
My guess is they're probably brachiopods, which are these two-shelled animals that look sort of like a clam or a bivalve, but they're really not too closely related. But they're interesting. And in fact, the Devonian was the age of the brachiopods, and they were very abundant, many, many species and very common. But they were really interesting, and there were so many of them. It was really an interesting occurrence in Milwaukee.
Well, you're gonna have some very detailed and wonderful photos in this book to take a look at, Jeff. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Miles in Milwaukee, your turn next. Hi, Miles.
Hey, Larry. How's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I had a couple places to share around the Milwaukee area where people can find some really nice fossils. Your guest already touched on the Lake Michigan. That's a perfect area to find various like crinoids, brachiopods, and other types of bivalves and things like that. But if you walk along the downtown area around Bradford Beach, there are large white dolomite outcroppings where you can find a lot of trilobites down there around the broken rocks and stuff. So I usually find like 10 or so when I'm out there a whole day. I found a couple really nice ones that just broke out perfectly. So just keep your eyes open and keep looking, and they're there.
Yeah, those blocks of rock came from quarries in Wauwatosa and Milwaukee. During the WPA days, when they're doing all kinds of public works things, they quarried them from those quarries and hauled them to the lakefront and put them up for shore retainment and stuff. There's lots of trilobites in there, fortunately, because those quarries are gone. So you can't go in the quarries anymore. They're filled in, but you can go and still to Bradford Beach
and
find trilobites.
And, you know, somebody's probably saying, what the heck's a trilobite? Or what was a trilobite?
Interesting question. It's an extinct form of arthropods, one of the more prominent types of arthropods in the fossil record from the early beginnings of life. They don't look much like anything today, but they had a lot of little legs. They can roll up in balls like pill bugs, and they can. If you see them, you can tell they're arthropods, but there's none living around, so it's hard to describe them anymore.
And there were several different kinds of trilobites in the Milwaukee Formation. The ones that along in the big white blocks that the fellow was just talking about were a little bit older. That's the Silurian period, a little before the Devonian. But and that there were quite a few more species of trilobites at that period of time.
And how far back was that?
That was more like close to 400 million years ago. The Devonian is a little bit younger than that, 350 or something like that. It's or 380 rather, but it's still a long time ago, and there was a lot of change and a lot of diversity happening still. Trilobites did eventually start to taper off, and by the end of the Paleozoic, they were all gone. But
well, I got to tell you, I mean, it's just to hold in your hand something that a fossil of something that lived 400 million years ago.
Interesting concept. Yeah, it's a real touch with reality. You don't think about that, but that's exactly what you're looking at is alien forms of life in some cases. When people first started to discover dinosaurs, they had no idea what they were. They were only finding isolated bones and stuff like that, and it's like looking at alien life forms because there's nothing else living today that looks like these animals.
Yeah, and how many – I'm just trying to remember from you. How many fossils do you have – did we have in the Milwaukee?
There were about 350 species that we know of. But in doing the research for the book, we found quite a few other examples of things that are probably new species. We haven't named any of them in the book. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we wrote the book was so that people could become aware of this and come out and study it in detail and actually prepare the material, because a lot of it hasn't been prepared to really identify what's new and what's not. And once that's done, there will be a lot more stuff coming out of it. But the researchers have to get in there and take a look at all this stuff.
Well, and this is published by SIRI, is it?
SIRI Scientific Press, S-I-R-I, SIRI Scientific Press in the U.K., yeah.
Yeah.
And they send it out real quick. I mean, if that's the best place to get. That's the cheapest place to get it, and they ship it out the fastest. So if anybody wants to get it, that's the where to get it from, right from the publisher and online.
SIRI Scientific Press.
Right.
Well, what's your – I'm going to ask you both now. What's your favorite fossil that you have in your book?
Well, mine would be – I don't know about Don's. Maybe Don's too, but mine would be the trilobite that's on the cover. It's a completely rolled up in a ball. It's got this thing called a hypostoma that's still attached on the underside, and it's the best – I think the best trilobite ever found in the Milwaukee Formation. So we made sure that was on the cover.
I think my favorite one is I have a specimen of a crinoid with a snail sitting on its anus. And they're called coprophagous animals because that snail, instead of walking around and finding things to eat, just sat on the crinoid, and the crinoid produced all its food.
I think that would be my favorite too, oddly. But Don couldn't find that, so it didn't make the book.
Yeah, we'll keep looking. He
couldn't find it amongst his vast collection. Hopefully he will. We could do another edition and have that in there.
How many do you have in your collection?
Me?
Yeah.
Tons. I have tons.
I don't even know.
In two states in about six locations.
Yeah. And I'm sure, Ken, you're the same.
Well, mine are all in one place. They're in the Milwaukee Public Museum and a little bit in the Weiser Science Museum.
Oh, yeah. Well, tell you what, it a lot of fun to talk with you. It was really fascinating to go through your book and look at the wonderful photography and learn some about the history of the area at the same time. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much for being with us. Ken Gass has been studying paleontology and collecting fossils in Wisconsin for over 50 years, written books on subjects ranging from paleontology to procedures, and he's published in magazines and peer-reviewed journals. Don McCulloch is a curator at the Weiss Earth Science Museum in Menasha, retired as a senior paleontologist at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and their book is titled Fossils of the Milwaukee Formation. That's the main title, published by SIRI Scientific Press, and that's probably a good place to get a copy of that book. Just go online, you can find it. Great to have them along. Always interesting to think about all that's happened in Wisconsin, from fossils to other key moments in our history, like how our state got its name, which we have some background on to share with you right now.
We recently received a flurry of questions through the Wisconsin Project from the fourth grade class at Mineral Point Elementary School. Most of the questions were about the state of Wisconsin. Questions like, how did Wisconsin get all of its cows? And Who invented the state dog? We sent WPR's Mary Kate McCoy to investigate.
When I saw these questions come in, I got really excited. It's because I'm from Mineral Point, and one question in particular stood out to me, from Josie Dunn. Because, full disclosure, I've known Josie for a long time.
Josie, we know each other, don't we?
Yeah.
How do we know each other?
You were my old babysitter.
Mm-hmm. We had some fun, didn't we? You wrote a question to Wisconsin, and what was your question?
How did Wisconsin get its name?
And why do you want to know the answer to that?
Because Wisconsin's a really unique name for a state, and I just really wanted to know why it was mainly called Wisconsin.
And what do you think the answer is?
Maybe the person who, like, lived in the state didn't really have a name yet, maybe made Wisconsin a state and named it after him.
And are you excited to find out the answer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it turns out that's a somewhat tricky question to answer. But what we do know is that it came from the Algonquian language family, spoken by Wisconsin tribes like the Menominee, Ojibwe, Potawatomi, and Mohican. And it certainly was not pronounced Wisconsin.
I was always told it was Wiscusset, and some people have said Wiscusin. There's a Wiscusset, a Wiscusset.
Napus is an elder in residence at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, a member of the Menominee tribe.
To translate that would be basically the first part comes from the word Wiscu, which means something good, and that ending is more, what you would say, locative. Then you would say a good place to, like, camp or to make a clearing or to basically live.
Rand Valentine is a University of Wisconsin-Madison Linguistics and American Studies professor. He offers another interpretation.
The word Wisconsin originates from an Algonquian language word, meskusing. And Meskwesing is probably Miami, Illinois language, but possibly Ojibwe. It's a little bit uncertain. And the word translates as where it lies red. And the best guess is that's making reference to the red cliffs around the Dells.
But once the French got a hold of the word, Napus says its pronunciation started to change.
The big confusion, though, was when the French came in. A lot of those names were mistranslated because basically they couldn't pronounce them.
Many scholars trace a European adoption of the name Wisconsin to the missionary and explorer Father Jacques Marquette. Valentine says the change came after he traveled across Wisconsin from Green Bay to the Mississippi River with fur trader Louis Joliet and two Miami Indians as guides.
He recorded this word as their word for the Wisconsin River. They themselves were refugees here in Wisconsin. There was lots of turmoil in the 17th century.
So then where did the W come from? Valentine says that came from a simple misreading of the text.
There was a famous mapmaker, and he showed the name to LaSalle, who mistook the first two letters, which were just this very flamboyant M, as O-I, which he interpreted as we.
Over time, as more English speakers settled into the area, the French spelling was changed to the more English W. Napus and Valentine agree that knowing where the name comes from is powerful.
If you're a language speaker, you should know what that means by breaking it down. And that's the importance of language, because if you don't have that quality, then you're just reciting.
When we recognize that this state's very name comes from one of the languages of the country's first people, it will perhaps give us a greater appreciation for their place, not just in the past, but in the present.
WPR's Mary Kate McCoy brought us this story. And Josie's question came to us through the Wisconsin Project. We'll hear even more questions from the Mineral Point fourth graders on the Larry Mueller Show on May 15th. Submit your own questions and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.